Good morning. Thanks to the organizers for organizing and to Perimeter for having me here. It's nice to be back. As you can see, I'm going to talk about quantum causal models. So, a few words of introduction to begin with. First of all, there's an existing framework which I'll refer to as classical causal models. And this framework describes classical random variables with specified causal relationships between them. The idea then is that the causal relationships between the random variables induce constraints on probability distributions, that is, constraints on, for example, the joint distribution over the random variables. And this framework is useful in many contexts. So, for example, it enables us to make inferences about causal structure in cases where we have observed data, let's say, but the causal structure is unknown or partially unknown to us. So why would we want to do that? Well, this in turn, for example, enables us to make deductions about what will happen in alternative scenarios. So, for example, if instead of just observing, I decide to intervene and fix a variable to have the value that I want, say it's a medical trial or something, and I decide this person is going to have the drug, I might want to know, well, what's going to happen to the other variables? Well, I need to know something about the causal structure to make that kind of inference. Well, framework also enables a rigorous account of classical counterfactual statements. So one of the central figures who worked on these classical causal models was Judea Pearl, who won a Turing Award for this work. He very much sees himself as having fought a kind of war against more traditional statisticians for whom any talk of causality was for a long time kind of infra dig, not properly scientific, something you might bring up in the pub perhaps, but not in proper scientific work. I guess he's doing pretty well in that war. For example, these are being used more and more widely. My own students now, instead of leaving and moving on into academic careers, have started leaving and taking up jobs with startup companies who combine machine learning techniques with classical causal models to try and get computers to reason in a sort of causal way, for example, and for this are paid 2.5 times the salary that I get. So it's certainly something that's, you know, attracting interest in the real world now, as well as in academia. Anyway, the main aim of this talk is to describe a corresponding framework for quantum causal models. So what would a motivation for that be? Well, I mean, first of all, just to see if there is one, it seems to me a sort of natural and interesting question, whether there is a sort of natural and compelling quantum analog to all this. Apart from that, I suppose there's some hope that it could turn out to be useful for things like quantum protocols, analyzing quantum protocols that sort of naturally have a causal structure with different agents sending things to each other and so forth. It would be a wonderful thing if it turned out to have any relevance at all to quantum gravity. You never know, I guess, although it's pretty early days for any such thing. So I fear I'm rather going to disappoint Lucian after his far-reaching introduction. Yes, other motivation is simply for the foundations of quantum mechanics. I actually sort of, which gives me motivation enough, I think, sort of thinking about this does suggest certain foundational ideas which are worth pursuing. All right. So the structure of the talk is going to be something like this. Before moving to the general case of classical or quantum causal models, I'm going to discuss in some detail a much simpler thing, which is just a scenario where one variable or system can be said to be a common cause for two other variables or systems. The common cause being the means by which those two things get correlated. Now, that might be the first half of the talk or so. It's going to move quite slowly because I really want to nail down the sort of conceptual ideas that are involved there before moving to the general case. Hopefully it will be easy to follow that part because it will be slow, like I said. And then once I've done that, there will be a sort of shift, like a sudden jump in the speed with which I present things, because I will move to the case of general classical and quantum causal models and present some more recent sort of technical results about those. But hopefully, having been careful through the basic ideas at the beginning, at least people will get a sort of sense of what's going on there. Okay, and then, well, finally, there'll be some conclusions where I'll make some foundational speculations if there's time. Okay, just so I don't have to keep saying this every time. Finitely valued random variables and finite dimensional Hilbert spaces throughout. Okay, so let's start with the thing I said I was going to start with, and that's the classical notion of a common cause. So we can go back at least as far as Reichenbach, writing in the 50s, and talk about Reichenbach's principle. Suppose that Y and Z are classical random variables, and suppose they are correlated, by which I mean statistically correlated. P of YZ is not equal to the product P of Y times P of Z. Well then, according to this principle, there should be some form of causal explanation for this correlation. And that might take one of several different forms. It could be, for instance, that Y is a cause of Z. Perhaps very directly, or perhaps more indirectly, that cause might be mediated by lots of other things. But ultimately, in some sense, one possible explanation is that Y is a cause of Z. Another possible explanation is that Z is a cause of Y. Okay. But we have this slogan, correlation is not causation, which I take to mean that just because they're correlated, it doesn't mean that either of these things hold, because another kind of causal explanation is that there's some common cause, say X, such that X is a cause of Y and X is a cause of Z. That way, it can become correlated. And okay, there's two other possibilities. If we decide that there are no loops, which we are going to decide, then I might have a common cause as well as a causal pathway from Y to Z or from Z to Y. Okay, but the principle also says little more than just that. It also picks out this particular kind of explanation. And it says that once X is richly enough specified, I'll say in that case that X is the complete common cause of Y and Z, then we get a constraint on the probabilities. But the principle is really saying that one always can find a variable X that is completely specified enough such that this constraint holds. And that constraint is, of course, that the correlation between Y and Z disappears when I condition on X. So in that particular scenario, the principle is saying I should have the P of YZ given X factorizes as P of Y given X times P of Z given X. Okay, that's fine. Now, let's think about that a bit. How might we, where does that principle come from? How might we justify it? Well, here and the rest of the talk, I'm going to follow Pearl's account set out, for example, in his book Causality, wherein he takes causal relationships, the things that are indicated by these arrows, to be facts about the world. So in this Greek jargon, I'll say that they are ontic. Whereas probabilities are the degrees of belief of a rational agent. In the same jargon, they are epistemic. So an agent doesn't always know the values of all the variables, therefore will put probability distributions on them. Well, okay, fine. But even given that, a question arises. Suppose that some rational agent takes the causal structure to be like this one. Then why should the rational agent arrange their beliefs such that Y and Z are conditionally independent given X? That's now some kind of constraint on the degrees of belief of this agent. What are they doing wrong if they don't do that? Are they irrational, for example? Will they lose bets or something like that? Where does this constraint actually come from? And what I'm going to give now is a partial answer to that question. To suppose that the agent cannot observe all variables, there might be other variables kind of hanging around here in this world apart from X, Y, and Z. And let's take it that actually causal relationships are fundamentally deterministic, that is, functional. So if we ask, what do these arrows even mean in these pictures? What does it mean to say X is a cause of Y? Well, it means that Y, in some underlying dynamics, is a function of X, perhaps and other things too, not just X. Okay. And suppose that in this particular example, the agent takes the functional relationships to be as follows. So, suppose there's some additional variable or name for collection of variables, just call it lambda, such that variable y is actually a function of x and also of lambda. And suppose that there are additional variables mu, non-overlapping with lambda, such that z is a function of x and of mu. Okay, so we've written that here. Y is some function fy of lambda and x, and z some function fz of mu and x. But in particular, we're saying here that y does not depend on mu, for instance, and z does not depend on lambda. Well, it's in a situation like that that I'll say that x is the complete common cause of y and z. There are other causes. Lambda is a cause of y, for instance. But x contains all the stuff which is a cause of y and also a cause of z. Okay, so suppose the agent takes the situation actually to be like this. Lambda and mu might be in some sense unobserved by that agent. And suppose further that the agent assigns a joint probability distribution to lambda x mu, which is a product distribution. So I'm just assuming without justification that these are independent in the sense that the agent puts a product probability distribution on them. I'm not going to try and justify that bit. That's why this is only a partial answer up there. There's more to be said about that, but not in this talk. Well, then it just follows that the agent will assign, the agent's own probability assignments respect these functions. Then it just follows that the agent will assign a marginal distribution on x, y, z, which has the property that y and z are conditionally independent given x. In other words, the conditional factorizes like this. So that goes some way towards telling a story which justifies this principle that says when you found a complete common cause, the probabilities should satisfy this thing. But actually, we can say a little more. This goes in the other direction too. So here's a theorem which expresses both directions. It says, I'm referring to it as the classical Reichenbach theorem. It's not that I'm attributing it to Reichenbach as such. He didn't really express himself quite in these terms, but I'm just sort of naming it after him. It says, given a conditional distribution, P of YZ given X, the following are equivalent. So the first statement is that it's possible to define random variables lambda mu and also functions fy and fz such that y is a function of lambda and x, z is a function of mu and x, and the joint distribution over those guys is just a product. And then the second statement is that p of yz given x factorizes. In other words, y and z are conditionally independent given x. Okay, so the previous slide was arguing from 1 to 2, and both directions means that also 2 implies 1. If I have a distribution that satisfies this, then I can define yada, 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 and yada, such that all of this holds. Okay, and here is the same thing, but sort of drawn in some circuit pictures. Suppose we think of that P of YZ given X as a classical channel. Formally, it sort of looks like a classical channel with X input and YZ output. Well then, what that theorem is saying is that that channel takes this factorized form if and only if it can be dilated to a function G such that it can all be written this way. So here's the channel itself, just taking X into YZ. Here it is dilated to a function G, written as a gate here, with latent or ancillary variables lambda and mu, each in some initial distribution. And then G has this property that it actually splits into functions fy and fz, such that y only depends on these bits and z only on these bits. Now, of course, in order to draw that picture, we had to use little symbol here. This dot is a classical copy of the x variable, because that variable needs to go into this gate so it can influence y, and also needs to go into that gate so it can influence z. Okay, so much for the classical case. Now, what I want to do now is tell a similar sort of story about the quantum case. So we'll be looking at the quantum notion of common cause. So suppose we start just by drawing a similar picture, one that sort of looks like the classical picture, except in some sense now, these will be quantum systems, A, B, and C. So some questions are, well, okay, this time round, what do these arrows even mean? Well, following the classical discussion, we expect the arrows to be telling us that A is in some sense a complete common cause of B and C. Okay. Let's suppose also that accompanying this picture, there'll be some quantum channel from A to BC, where by quantum channel, I mean a trace-preserving CP map. Well then, again, following the classical case, we should expect that this idea that A is the complete common cause of B and C puts a constraint on that channel, where that constraint will be the quantum analog of the classical factorization of this guy. And if we can work all that out, we'll have a sort of quantum analog of classical Reichenbach theorem. So that's what we're going to do next. And the basic idea is that instead of assuming underlying functions, will assume an underlying unitary transformation. So we'll get to that on the next slide. Just a couple of things we have to get through first. This is just notation. Consider a quantum channel with input A and output B corresponding to a CP map E. So a state rho B is that map applied to a state rho A. I'm going to make a lot of use of this. I'll write down channels by writing down Choi-Jamulkowski isomorphic operators, which I'll define like this. So for a particular channel E, I'll define this operator here by this. So that's at least a version of the normal Choi-Jamulkowski isomorphism. This ket and this bra are defined on Hilbert space HA. I've chosen to do this in such a way that these ones are defined on A star, which is the dual of that Hilbert space. There's a reason for that, which is it means that, first of all, the definition of this operator is independent of my choice of basis that I made when I wrote down this expression. And second of all, it means that this is a positive operator. So it's, for those reasons, it's a convenient convention to use. If you take that operator and trace out B, you're left with the identity operator on A. Okay. And now, in the classical case, we needed to talk about when in some function a variable depended on another variable and when it didn't. So now we need to say something about the analog of that with unitaries. So suppose I have a generic bipartite unitary. Looks like this, inputs AB, outputs CD. I'm going to say that In this unit tree, B does not influence C if the following holds. The condition is that for all inputs, row A, the marginal output at C, that's row C, is independent of the input at B. So I'm imagining here a product input in particular, which is just some state on A, tensor product with some state on B. Equivalently, you can express that as a mathematical condition on the Choi-Jamolkowski operator for the unit tree, which looks like that. So that there is a sort of important conceptual thing here, which is that part of this definition involves for all inputs, row A. In a scenario where this does not hold, it might still happen that for some very special input A, you find that the marginal at C doesn't depend on B. That would be a case that we would later refer to as fine-tuning. But this condition isn't saying just that. It's saying that no matter what input you put at A, you'll find that the output at C doesn't depend on the input at B. So in particular, you know, if you imagine a little guy down here trying to signal to C by varying the input, he won't be able to. Okay, so that's what it's going to mean in the quantum case when we have a unitary to say that some things do not influence other things. And now, because we're interested in common causes, we'll be considering unitaries that have this shape. We've got three inputs here and three outputs. We've got our A, B, and C. There's an extra output, which unitaries are reversible. So there may have to be an extra output, but it's not labeled because we're not interested in it. We'll say here that A is the complete common cause of B and C if this input here, mu, does not influence B, and also this input here, lambda, does not influence C. So at least with respect to this particular factorization of the input, we can say that A is the only thing that influences both B and also C. That's why it's the complete common cause. Okay, and now an actual result. This I'm referring to as the quantum Reichenbach theorem because it's the analog of the classical one that I presented earlier. This is from this paper, joint with John Mark Allen, Kiran Lee, Rob Sveckens, Dom Horseman, published in PRX now. The theorem says, well, suppose I'm given some channel from A into BC, well, then the following statements are equivalent. And the first statement is that there exists a unitary dilation of that channel involving latent or ancilla systems lambda and mu, such that in that unitary, A is the complete common cause of B and C. And well, this is sort of implicit in the way we usually use the word dilation, but let's be explicit. The joint input state there will be a product, rho lambda, rho A, rho mu. And the thing that that's equivalent to is this mathematical statement about the channel. That the Choi-Jamolkowski operator for the channel has this product form. Okay, and the equivalence means this goes both ways. So if I start with this unitary situation where A is a complete common cause, then when I look at the marginal channel from A to BC, it'll have this form. And in the other direction, if I start with a channel of this form, I can always find the unitary dilation with the necessary features to make A a complete common cause of B and C. Okay, so this is the quantum Reichenbach theorem. A quick couple of remarks about that there. This right-hand side is simply a product of two operators. It looks like they act on different Hilbert spaces. Whenever I write something like that, I'm using a convention where if it looks like two things act on different Hilbert spaces, actually they're just being padded with identities on the Hilbert spaces that they need to make them act on the same Hilbert space. Okay, that's what's going on here. You might worry about the order of these and whether they commute. Why didn't I write it the other way? Well, actually they do commute if this holds, which you can see by taking the Hermitian conjugate of both sides of the equation. Good. And, okay, a bit more of a technical remark that I won't sort of pursue particularly much in this talk, is that each of these conditions is also equivalent to each of these conditions. So one is that if I take the Choi-Joe-Murkowski operator for my channel, renormalize it so that it's trace one, well, now it kind of formally appears like a quantum state, and I can evaluate the quantum conditional mutual information on it, and the statement is that that thing's zero. And then from some work by Hayden and others, they derived the explicit form for tripartite quantum states that satisfy this thing here. And from that, we know that this means that the A Hilbert space has a certain kind of decomposition to what's going on here. It says it decomposes into a direct sum over orthogonal subspaces. And then inside each one of those subspaces is a sort of factorization into two bits. And then the channel itself is just a sum of things, where inside each subspace, the left piece goes off to system B and the right piece goes off to system C. Okay, and in the classical case, having done the classical Reichenbach theorem, I had a slide where we sort of said the same thing, but explicitly in circuit pictures. We can do this here too. So the statement becomes that the channel has this product form if and only if it can be dilated to a unitary such that the following holds. So here's the circuit with just the channel itself appearing as a gate, CP map. Here it is dilated to a unitary. Now that unitary will have the common cause properties, that is, lambda does not influence C and mu does not influence B. But those facts are not sort of apparent in this picture here. But they can be made apparent if we decide to draw the picture in this way. So any such unitary, it can be shown, can be decomposed so that it looks like this, where I've got some unitary V composed of pieces VI that acts on lambda and A, and a commuting unitary W made of pieces WI that acts on A and mu. And finally, B and C coming out of those. So here the causal structure is apparent. It's apparent in the picture that B only depends on lambda and A and not on mu, for instance. Classically, to draw our classical version of that picture, we needed a dot to represent a classical copy of a variable. In the quantum case, there is no copy, there's no cloning. So we have a new symbol that represents something else. Now, I'm not going to do this formally and properly because in this talk we're mainly not doing this. But the symbol represents the decomposition of the A Hilbert space that I was talking about on that last slide, a sort of factorization inside different subspaces. Okay, now what? Yeah, I think we're going to skip this for time. You can always come back. So that was what I described as the first half of the talk, where we had a sort of close and detailed look at the situation of one variable or system being a complete common cause for two others, and the classical Reichenbach theorem and the corresponding quantum Reichenbach theorem. So what we're going to do now is just generalize those ideas to the case of arbitrary causal structures. So here's a definition of a classical causal model. It's comprised of essentially two ingredients. One of those ingredients is a directed acyclic graph with random variables on nodes. So our random variables here are x1, x2, x3, x4, and these arrows represent the causal relationships. And the second ingredient that makes this thing a classical causal model is a set of conditional probabilities. So that set includes, for each I, where I indexes random variables, a probability of xi conditioned on the parents of that node in the graph. So here, that's PA subscript I. PA subscript I denotes the parents of xi, which is the set of nodes xk such that there is an arrow in the DAG from xk to xi. Okay, so those two ingredients together make up a classical causal model. The idea is that one forms the joint distribution over all of these variables simply by taking the product of all those conditionals. And then part of the point, in a way, is that not every joint distribution over x1 to xk has that particular form. So there are constraints on this joint distribution, which we can see as being imposed by the structure of this directed acyclic graph that represents the causal relationships. All right, well, we'll say a bit more about classical causal models in a few moments. But before that, let's move immediately to the general definition of a quantum causal model. It's going to look like this. It involves, again, two ingredients, really. The first ingredient is a directed acyclic graph. So here's four quantum systems with some arrows representing causal relationships. Now, this time, each node is going to be associated with, well, actually a tensor product of two Hilbert spaces. So it's Hilbert space Hi, which I'm going to think of as somehow the incoming system at that particular node. So sometimes I'll refer to it as the incoming Hilbert space. And then another Hilbert space, which is the dual of that one, which I'll think of as the outgoing system from that node. So sometimes I'll refer to it as the outgoing Hilbert space. Okay, so that's the first ingredient, if you like. The second ingredient is that to make a quantum causal model, this will be accompanied by a set of channels, which in their Choi-Jo-Murkowski form will look like operators like this. For each I, there's a channel from the parents of that node, actually from the output Hilbert spaces of the parents of that node, into the input Hilbert space of that node. Okay, so in Choi-Jo-Murkowski form, that is a positive operator acting on those particular Hilbert spaces. And then we have an additional constraint, which is that for all nodes, xi and xj, if I look at the channel from the parents of xi into xi and the channel from the parents of xj into xj, they should commute. Okay. And then the idea is that we form an overall operator that acts on all of the Hilbert spaces, on all of the nodes. So if there are n nodes, that's 2n Hilbert spaces altogether, simply by taking the product of all these channel operators. So that operator, in this talk I'm going to call it a process matrix, because it is the same thing as what the people are talking about who've written papers on process matrices. So for example, for this graph on the left, that process matrix, sigma, would have this form. Product of commuting terms. One of those terms is a channel from x2 to x4. One is channel from the outputs of 1 and 2 into x3. Then, well, x2 given x1. And here, well, x1 doesn't have any parents in this DAG, so it's row of x1 given the empty set, if you like, which is just a state on the input Hilbert space for x1. So that's what that is on the end. Now, if we sort of look at this condition about commuting, sometimes it's trivial. Like if we look at this operator here, x4 given x2, and this one here, x3 given x2 and x1, it's trivial that they commute because they have non-trivial action on different Hilbert spaces. So, you know, even to talk about commutation there. Oh, no, they don't. Sorry, that's not a good example to give you. Is there a good example in here? Yes. Let's look at x4 given x2 and x2 given x1. And then I'll come to the other one. This one acts on the input Hilbert space of x4 and the output of x2. This one acts on the input of x2 and the output of x1. So it's trivial that they commute. Even to talk about commutation, I'm sort of surreptitiously padding with identities to make them act on the overall Hilbert space. But those operators have non-trivial action on different Hilbert spaces, so they commute for that simple reason. But sometimes it's not so trivial. So yeah, in the case I just mentioned, this x4 given x2 and x3 given x2, x1, well, both of those act on the output Hilbert space of x2. So the idea that they commute becomes a non-trivial constraint. Okay, so far, this definition, I've not said anything yet that really justifies it as the compelling definition of a quantum causal model or the correct definition, something like that. It's essentially, at this stage, a sort of guess, given what we've already said about the simplest case of A to BC, where we found the channel from A to BC should have this product form here. I basically just generalized that idea, where this thing is a product and those commute, into the idea that this sigma is a product of terms which commute. So what I'm going to do now is present kind of quickly a theorem that does the work of justifying this definition in the same way that our classical Reichenbach theorem did the work of justifying classical statement about factorizing conditional independences, and our quantum Reichenbach theorem did the same for the quantum case. Okay, just before that, some remarks. Yes, the approach of two Hilbert spaces per node has much in common with various formalisms that have appeared before, such as the multi-time formalism of Aronhov and Popescu and others. Process matrices introduced by Fabio Costa, Ogni and Oreshkov, Czaslaw Bruckner, quantum combs introduced by the Pavia group. The novel aspect here is the constraints that we get on that sigma from a particular causal structure. The two Hilbert space approach allows for the possibility of interventions at nodes. So an intervention corresponds to a quantum instrument mediating between the input Hilbert space and the output Hilbert space. Think of a little agent sitting at that node somehow, doing something to the quantum system as it goes in and getting some outcome, and then the system goes out again. Joint probabilities for the outcomes of these interventions are obtained from sigma by a trace rule. But we can also consider there being no intervention at a node, which sort of corresponds to an identity channel between input and output Hilbert spaces. So marginalization, for example, in the case of no intervention, will correspond to tracing out both the input and the output Hilbert spaces at a node, but with an extra operator put in there corresponding to the identity channel that links them up. Okay, now this business of justifying the definition. We've already argued that in this simple case here, the DAG is to be interpreted in terms of an underlying unitary evolution with A the complete common cause of B and C. It followed by one direction of the quantum Reichenbach theorem that the channel should satisfy that constraint. This leads to a process matrix of this form, rho of B given A times rho of C given A times rho A. That's consistent with the general definition on the previous slide. Previous slide but one applied to this particular DAG. Okay, and now a generalization of that theorem will play a similar role in the case of an arbitrary DAG. Here it is. Because I want to say some other stuff too, I'm going to do this in a semi-formal kind of way. So consider a DAG G with nodes x1 to xn and a Hilbert space of that form, the input and the output one for each xi. Consider a positive operator sigma which acts on all those Hilbert spaces. Then the following are equivalent. So again, this is a statement about an equivalence of two things. One of those things is just sigma taking that product form. Product of operators, each is rho of xi given the parents of xi in the DAG for some pairwise commuting set of channel operators. And the claim is that this is equivalent to this statement here, which states that there exists a unitary comb or a unitary circuit, essentially, which we can regard as the underlying thing that's really happening when we wrote down our particular DAG, with causal structure corresponding to the DAG G, such that our operator sigma is returned when we marginalize over the latent variables here. So if we start with this thing and then marginalize over all the lambdas and these primed variables, we're left with our sigma as given. Okay, now the reason this is a semi-formal presentation is that I haven't really said here what it means to say with causal structure corresponding to the DAG-G. But just for example, in this picture, it looks as if you might be able to signal from x1 to xn. Even if all the other x's are blocked, perhaps a little agent here sort of blocks that system, like throws that system in the bin and prepares just a maximally mixed state to send forward or something. So an agent here can sort of block the signal in that way. It looks like x1 can nonetheless signal to xn because there's a path going through all these primed variables up there and finally influencing xn like that. But in the DAG, there might not be an arrow from x1 to xn, which is supposed to mean that x1 can't influence xn directly in that sense, only perhaps in a way mediated by other x's. And so this having the causal structure corresponding to the DAG-G means in that particular example that that can't happen. In other words, these unitaries are chosen in a specific way such that actually it turns out that this guy can't signal to that guy up there, at least not if all the other x's are blocked. And with a bunch of constraints of that form, you show that you can construct a cone which satisfies them. And that's what I mean by causal structure corresponding to the DAG. Okay, and finally, some results to do with independences of things and their relationships to causal structure. So let's go back again to classical causal models. In classical causal models, the structure of the DAG places constraints on the joint probability distribution in the form of conditional independences. So in the distribution, some sets of variables are independent from other sets conditioned on third sets. And in fact, as I was getting at in the introduction, actually, it's these conditional independences that allow us to make inferences about what the underlying causal structure might be, cases where we don't know it, but let's say do have some observational data. And that enables us to answer questions like, what if I actively intervene at a node, fix it to have a value, what happens to the other variables, that sort of thing. Perl has something called the do calculus that formalizes some of this. So I'm not going to go into the whole do calculus because it would take too long. But here's a small part of it. Here's a definition of this little expression. So S is some subset of the nodes of the DAG. T, a disjoint subset, and U, another disjoint subset. And this is a definition of the phrase S and T are deseparated by U. The important thing to take away is that it's just a graphical fact about the DAG. It's nothing to do with probabilities and things like that. It's just a sort of graphical statement about this DAG and where the arrows go. There it is in detail. I propose that I don't go through all that in detail. I'm happy to come back to it. Kind of looks complicated, but is intuitive actually once you've got used to it. The importance of this definition is the role it plays in this do calculus, or in the particular case I'm going to look at, this theorem, which says that deseparation is sound and complete for the joint distribution over the ST and U nodes to have the property that S and T are conditionally independent given U. Sound means that if deseparation holds on the DAG, then in any distribution that's compatible or Markov for that DAG, this will hold. Complete means is that if on the DAG deseparation fails, then I can find at least one joint distribution compatible with the DAG, such that this does not hold. Okay. So the important thing to take away here is this theorem that makes a connection for arbitrary DAGs between graphical structure of the DAG, conditional independences in the probability distribution. And now I want to say something similar for the quantum case. However, in order to do so, I need to introduce one more thing, which is the idea of a classical split node model. And the reason for doing this is that this thing is really more analogous to the quantum thing than the traditional kind of classical model I've been talking about so far. So very quickly, I'll define classical split node model like this. It's a directed acyclic graph. Each node now has two random variables, which I'll regard as the input variable at that node and the output variable at that node. So that's more analogous in the sense that I have two variables there and I had two Hilbert spaces for the quantum case. And we get a set of conditional probabilities for each I, P of Xi in, given the output variables for the parent nodes of Xi. If I multiply all those together, I get what is essentially a classical process matrix, just the classical version of the thing we've been calling a quantum process matrix, which formally is a conditional probability distribution over input variables given output variables. It allows, for example, for joint probabilities of outcomes to be calculated when agents make arbitrary interventions at nodes. And if there's no intervention at a node, we should put a delta there so that x out takes the same value as x in. And now I want to look at the idea of independence in these split node models. So quick reminder, first of all, given three random variables, there are a few different ways of stating the fact that y and z are conditionally independent given x. Up till now, I've mainly been writing it like this, but these other statements are all equivalent, up to a tiny wrinkle about this one being undefined if p of x is zero for some value. But we can ignore that. And now I want to make a definition that applies to split node classical causal models. So consider disjoint subsets of nodes S, T, and U. We'll say that S and T are strongly independent relative to U if that classical process matrix has this form. It has the form of a product of two terms, where one term is a function on the input and output variables of S and U nodes, and the other on input and output variables of T and U nodes. Obviously, in a sort of visual sense, that equation sort of matches this one, just for ordinary classical random variables. We can make an equivalent operational statement to this. It says that for all possible interventions at the ST and U nodes, if I consider those interventions being done, but then just look at the resulting joint distribution over input and output variables, well, it satisfies the standard kind of conditional independence, like this. Okay. I'm also going to define S and T are weakly independent relative to U, which is a similar thing, except instead of considering arbitrary interventions of those S, T, and U nodes, we just consider the case that no one intervenes, in which case deltas are inserted such that input variables take the same values as output variables. And I'll say S and T are weakly independent relative to U if just in that case we find that, well, let's say, the input variables satisfy the usual idea of conditional independence. And to make the distinction, it's helpful to see a quick example where weak independence holds but not strong. Look at this. It's a simple DAG. I've only got x and y. It's a split node model, so I've got x in and x out, and variables y in and y out. Suppose that y in here is actually a function of x out, such that if x out is 0, y in is 0. If x out is 1, y in is 0. If x out is 2, y in is 1. Okay, so x is actually a trit and y a bit. And suppose that the probability distribution over the x in values has all its support on the values 0 and 1. We could say, for instance, x in has a half probability to be 0 and a half probability to be 1. Well, my point here is that if no one intervenes and changes things, then because x is in is either 0 or 1 with certainty, then yn turns out to be 0 with certainty. X is never 2, so y is never 1. Well, if yn is 0 with certainty, then trivially this factorization holds, which means that weak independence holds. On the other hand, it's false that the classical process matrix in this example can be written as a product of two terms. sorry, it shouldn't be S and T there, but X and Y. Alpha on X and beta on Y. And one way of seeing that is just to consider, well, if there is a little agent at X here, they can signal to Y, they can send messages to Y, for example, by deciding whether or not to fix X out to have the value 2. Someone at Y can tell whether X out had the value 2 or not. So strong independence fails. Okay, and just before our final sort of quantum theorem, some theorems about classical split node models. It's kind of matching the one I had for standard single variable classical causal models. First of all, deseparation is sound and complete, or strong relative independence to hold. So certain graphical property of the DAG implies certain property of the classical process matrix, what I was calling strong relative independence. And separately, one can also show that deseparation is sound and complete for weak relative independence there. So here's the quantum version of that. Given a quantum causal model, consider disjoint subsets of nodes STU, and we'll say that S and T are strongly independent relative to U if now the quantum process matrix takes this factored form of a term alpha that only acts non-trivially on S and U, and beta that only acts non-trivially on T and U Hilbert spaces, and this is for some Hermitian operators alpha and beta. And then the theorem is that deseparation is sound and complete for that thing. So we've managed to prove a theorem which relates the graphical structure of the DAG in a quantum causal model to some property of the process matrix, which I'm taking to be an analog of a kind of classical conditional independence. I think that's all I really want to say, so I'll finish just with some remarks. First of all, if sigma is diagonal with respect to some product basis, well, that means it basically is a classical example. Well, in that case, a quantum causal model reduces to a split node classical model, and our notion of quantum strong relative independence reduces to the classical one. Alternatively, in the case of just a tripartite state, the definition of quantum strong relative independence reduces just to the usual definition of quantum conditional independence on tripartite states. That is, we have that rho ABC for a tripartite state is of this product form, if and only if the quantum conditional mutual information vanishes. So it's kind of nice that our definition is doing the obvious things that it ought to do in these special cases. And some conclusions. Following a close look at the notions of common cause and independence, we've given a definition for quantum causal models. I should mention at this point, there are other approaches to these ideas in the literature. Perhaps the most similar is that of F. Costa and Fabio Costa and Sally Shrapnel, published here. But there are some significant differences. At the time, I won't go into explaining at length what the differences between what they were doing and what I've been doing are. A look at classical split node models reveals various senses in which two sets of nodes might be regarded as independent relative to a third. And at least one of these, that's the strong relative independence, has a quantum analog with a corresponding deseparation theorem. Actually, we have gone a bit further than this, but not in this talk. This theorem is a special case of the first rule of the quantum Dew calculus, which supplies quantum analogs for all three rules of Pearl's classical Dew calculus. And I'll finish off with some slightly sort of random, more foundational remarks. The classical formalism has a natural interpretation wherein causal structure is explained in terms of underlying functional relationships between variables. Functional relationships are taken to be facts about the world, in the jargon ontic. Probabilities arise when an agent does not know the values of all variables, hence expresses degrees of belief with a probability distribution, which in that same jargon is epistemic. The existence of a compelling quantum analog to the classical formalism with unitaries replacing functions lends support to the view that the unitaries and the causal structure they define are ontic, and that the positive operators that we write down are epistemic. But if something's epistemic, okay, it's someone's information, but the question is always there, information about what? In a completely operational approach, we'd just say it's information about the outcomes of possible interventions. If we want to go beyond that, we eventually need to be able to say that it's information about something in the world. Perhaps, for instance, the ontic states of some underlying theory. Now, one thing I haven't given you is a quantum analog of the other notion that we have for classical split node models, weak relative independence. It's not obvious that there ought to be such an analog, but I judge it to be a question of some interest, even foundational interest of whether there is or not, because in the classical split node case, weak relative independence essentially expresses just the ordinary conditional independence of the variables in the case that no one intervenes. It's somehow less operational than the strong notion, because the strong notion has an operational statement in terms of for all interventions you might do, certain things are independent, conditioned on other things. But of course, in the quantum case, in the absence of the some underlying theory I mentioned, there are no underlying variables. So that's why I said it's not obvious that there should be a quantum analog of this weak relative independence. But if we manage to formulate such an analog, we could see it as a kind of clue to the nature of the underlying theory, or a constraint on that underlying theory. The idea would be that weak relative independence should express some sort of statistical conditional independence relation that an agent's information about the underlying ontic states should satisfy. Okay, and I will stop there. Thanks.
Question, possibly two questions, concerning the classical the classical case, classical causal models. You made at the outset sort of a standing assumption that that all causal relationships should be deterministic, but of course even in classical probability theory we can consider non-deterministic processes. Does anything much change if you allow, say, stochastic matrices instead of functions to govern the causal relationships, or does just everything blow up?
So it was important for me to talk about functional relationships because I was trying to tell a story which would justify, for example, the classical Reichenbach's principle. So given a DAG, perhaps just x to yz, why should it hold that p of yz given x takes that factorized form? I mean, of course, you can just assert that by definition, but then why is that definition the right one or a good or of practical use in the real world, for instance? And so it was by talking about underlying functions that I was able to tell a story where that particular form emerged as the conclusion of a theorem. And something I didn't do was that same argument for the case of a general DAG. But one could pose the same question. There's this idea of a joint distribution being compatible with the DAG. Sometimes people say Markov for the DAG. And then you ask, well, why, if it's some agent's beliefs, why does it have to be Markov for the DAG? And again, you can tell a story about underlying functions and prove a theorem that says, if what the DAG is really capturing is the structure of these underlying functions, then as a theorem, in fact, the distribution will satisfy that thing. And so we have this story that goes at least some of the way to justifying that basic statement that the distribution should be Markov for the DAG. Now, if you remove the idea of underlying determinism, you don't have a story anymore. I mean, you can still define classical causal models and work with them. It's just that if you're the sort of person interested in foundations, you no longer have the same sort of justification for why things are done that way. There are other approaches, for example, involving de Finetti theorems. It's a kind of causal classical de Finetti theorem which appears in a paper by Miguel Navasquez. Are you on that one, Ellie? Sorry, I've forgotten who all... Yes, Ellie Wolf and Miguel Navasquez. Yeah, so there could be a different approach to the foundations of classical causal models that involves an appeal to kind of de Finetti theorem rather than underlying determinism. Yes. Yes, so the ones that are written down as part of a quantum causal model will always have definite causal structure, right. Just sort of by definition almost.
Okay, and also conversion. That any process
matrix will admit a DAG representation. Would that be unique? So, yes, it will admit a DAG representation. Even in the classical case, it's not unique as such. In other words, given a probability distribution, there can be more than one DAG, such that that distribution is Markov for that DAG. For example, in the classical case, I can always just write down a sort of complete DAG with arrows.
Yeah.
Sort of everywhere, and any distribution will be Markov on that. The reason one wouldn't do that in practice is that if the distribution has conditional independences, the complete DAG is a bad explanation because it's not explaining why those conditional independences hold. This is what's called fine-tuning. Yeah, so you sort of start to get into the question of, is there always a DAG such that the distribution is not fine-tuned on that DAG? The answer to that is no. And I would expect similar things in the quantum case.
Go to copies and ask questions.